Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio program from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Laura Kabelka in Berlin. This week on the show, European leaders backing Ukraine in DC.
I think that we had very good conversation with President Trump.
Very good.
And it really was the best one. Maybe the best one will be in the future. And we spoke about very sensitive points. The first one is security guarantees.
Then, unexpected tariffs for Switzerland.
I suspect we, at the end of the year, we will look at this as a bad year for Swiss trade, but not a catastrophic year.
And a Norwegian festival where sounds take center stage. We start with another highly anticipated meeting with US President Donald Trump. After a disastrous meeting in February, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was again in the Oval Office on Monday. But this time it went quite differently. Not only did Zelensky arrive in the company of EU leaders like Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, but the mood was noticeably more friendly.
President Zelensky, you look fabulous in that suit.
I said the same thing.
Yeah, look, you look good.
I said the same thing.
Yeah, looks good.
I said the one that attacked you last time.
But how productive was this meeting really? And did Europe manage to get a seat at the table? To discuss this, we have DW political correspondent Thomas Sparrow with us. Thomas, good to have you. To start, could you set the scene for us? What was this meeting like?
It was a meeting that was very important for all parties involved. For Ukraine, obviously, for the European partners, but I would say also for the United States. And according to those who were there, to those who have commented also afterwards on the meeting, it was a meeting that went much better than expected. And if we judge specifically from a European perspective, after all, I'm reporting from Germany, from Europe, this was a meeting that I would say also went better than expected. For the Europeans, for European leaders like French President Macron, like German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, it was all about making sure that Ukraine's interests were discussed and taken into consideration, but also that Europe's security considerations also played a role at the table. If we judge by what happened in Alaska, when US President Trump had met with Vladimir Putin, the main concern that European leaders had expressed was that it was a meeting without Ukraine and without Europeans. So from that perspective, the meeting did go quite well. But what it also revealed is that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done before peace can be reached in Ukraine. It's a much more challenging issue than perhaps some have expected it to be.
What role is Germany playing here as Europe's biggest economy and Ukraine's key supporter next to the US? Is Berlin shaping this process?
I wouldn't say shaping the process, but I would say that Germany's Chancellor Friedrich Merz is playing an important role within Europe. In fact, he chaired a meeting ahead of the Alaska meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And that was a meeting that was attended by several European leaders. And also, by the way, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky came to Berlin for that. And that actually also paved the way for European leaders to then, after the Alaska meeting, actually go together to the White House. And the fact that you had all these European leaders together at the White House with Zelensky meeting Trump is indeed a sign to a large extent of that role that Germany is playing at the international scene. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that essentially when you look at the meeting in Alaska between the two leaders, between Trump and Putin, essentially Europe didn't play an important role there. And there are many that are actually fearing that when it comes to actually signing an agreement, signing a deal to making sure that there's some kind of peace in Ukraine, that Europe's interest will not necessarily be considered as much as European leaders would like to. So far, I would agree to a certain extent, but it will ultimately be important to see what that is like when you're in the process of discussing and deciding on all those important issues that will be part of any peace agreement in Ukraine.
On Monday, was there then any real breakthrough at this meeting? Was there anything concrete?
Security guarantees is the absolute key term here. And I think from a European perspective, it is relevant to note that the US was on board when it comes to giving Ukraine security guarantees, because again, the fear was that a peace deal would not necessarily be supported in terms of security guarantees for Ukraine from the part of the United States. But the key elements there, the concrete elements there, will also be how they're all decided on, when they're decided on. So all the details, the actual concrete information of what those security guarantees actually mean. And that is something that cannot be decided so quickly, that will need a lot more consideration and discussion from the perspective of NATO, from the perspective of also European leaders and European institutions, also what role the United States would play, whether it would mean troops on the ground, whether it would meet some sort of commitment from NATO, whether it would be some sort of Article 5-like commitment from NATO. That's something that's being discussed as well. Those are all details that are still a bit up in the air. And a second element is something that was also not discussed, at least in detail, at least not publicly, in the meeting on Monday. Namely, the focus ahead of Alaska had been on Ukraine giving up part of its territory, which was obviously a huge thing for Ukraine and for the Europeans. They don't believe that's the best way forward to speak at this point of any kind of swap in territory or territory being given up. So at least from a European perspective, it was good that the focus on Monday at the White House was not on any kind of territory that Ukraine needs to then leave. It would be a discussion further on from a European perspective. The first step, however, would be a ceasefire. And that is not something where necessarily European leaders see eye to eye with the United States. The US, especially the US government under Donald Trump, think that there could be a deal without a ceasefire first. For European leaders like Friedrich Merz or Macron, first a ceasefire would be needed to then be able to discuss all the other elements. And among all those other elements, you would then have the very important, very controversial issue of territory swap or any kind of territory discussion.
The US seems to be clearly the key mediator right now. Trump is even planning to bring Zelensky and Putin together soon. So does Europe actually have a seat at this table?
If you judge by the fact that you had those European leaders sitting at the same table with Donald Trump, the fact that Donald Trump invited them to the White House, that they were there in the White House discussing these important issues for the future of Ukraine, I think European leaders going back to their own countries will feel that it was an important meeting and one where they were able to reinforce those important views from Europe, the need for a ceasefire, the need for that very important discussion on territories to be a little bit postponed, the fact that security guarantees need to be very important on the table, the fact that the US also needs to play a role when it comes to those security guarantees. However, this is not necessarily a sprint, it is more of a marathon kind of thing. So discussing all the details that will form part of a peace deal, of a peace agreement, will very probably take time. And it's in that longer process where it will be interesting to see what kind of role Europe plays, what kind of influence European Union leaders have when it comes to ultimately finding that agreement between Russia and Ukraine.
Thank you so much, Thomas.
Always a pleasure.
DW political correspondent Thomas Barrow. Russia's full-scale war in Ukraine has been going on for about 2 years and 6 months now. At least 13,883 Ukrainian civilians have since been killed, according to the UN Human Rights Monitor. One thing everyone seems to have learned about Trump by now is the fact that he is unpredictable. One of the latest countries to experience this firsthand is Switzerland. On August 1st, Trump levied a shocking 39% tariff rate against Swiss exports, much higher than the 15% negotiated by the European Union earlier this summer. Switzerland is not a member of the EU and has long been skeptical about integrating with the bloc on topics like trade, security and energy. So has its aloofness toward the European project suddenly become a liability? Novelist and journalist Jesse Jefska-Stevens reports from Geneva.
On August 1st, when Donald Trump announced sweeping 39% tariffs against Swiss goods, Switzerland was a picture of summer paradise. Locals streamed to its many lakes and riversides or took cool refuge in mountain peaks. Then, everything changed.
Well, the problem with Switzerland, we have a $40 billion deficit with Switzerland.
The mood in the blindsided nation was suddenly one of total catastrophe, reported Zurich-based newspaper NZZ, as affected manufacturers began to assess the fallout and the current right-wing government its humiliating defeat. Trump's tariffs are based on trade deficits. At $40 billion, Switzerland's is currently at a historic high. The dark humor to the situation is that most of this deficit has been driven by Trump himself. Switzerland refines one-third of the world's gold, exports of which soared in recent months as U.S. investors tried to insulate themselves from market chaos caused by, you guessed it, tariff negotiations. The resulting gold rush artificially inflated the trade deficit without contributing much to the GDP of either nation. That's because Switzerland is refining gold, not producing it, while U.S. investors are simply converting financial assets from one form to another. So the value added is minimal. But there are other reasons Switzerland found itself uniquely vulnerable to the tariffs. Cedric Vermouth, co-leader of the pro-European center-left Social Democratic Party, feels that the Swiss would have been better protected from the shocking tariffs had they aligned more closely with the European Union.
Probably the biggest deal ever reached in any capacity, trade or beyond trade.
It is.
It's a giant deal with lots of countries.
Notably, the EU negotiated a much better, if still painful, 15% rate earlier this year.
There is going to be just one stable trade partner for the next years if you want to uphold, let's say, a minimum level of decency, human rights, democracy, international law, multilateralism. Neither Peking nor Moscow are an alternative. So the only thing that is left is quite obviously Brussels.
For the past decade, integration with the EU has remained a fraught topic in Switzerland, rocking local politics and lacking public support. During bilateral talks last year, only 37% of the public thought relations with the EU were not close enough. Against a backdrop of rising geopolitical uncertainty and an unreliable United States, however, aligning more closely with Brussels might suddenly look more attractive. Simon Evanet, professor of geopolitics and strategy at the International Institute of Management Development in Lausanne, agrees that Switzerland was uniquely vulnerable to the tariffs, but points to different causes.
So in other words, we should not let the advocates of joining forces with the EU rewrite history here, because the negotiations which were done in Turnberry and in the run-up to that were painful for the EU.
Right.
Exceptionally painful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one should be careful what you take as a model.
Rather than seeking to integrate with the EU, Evanet believes, Switzerland should learn to better interpret the signals coming out of Washington and update its negotiating strategy accordingly. The outlook for the Swiss economy, meanwhile, is likely less doomsday than the initial media frenzy suggested. There's a reason to expect that tariffs will be reduced in further rounds of negotiations late this year or early next. Gold has already been exempt. Pharmaceuticals were never included, though the industry faces separate negotiations on drug pricing. As for luxury goods like Rolex watches, elite consumers are more likely to absorb higher prices, which, Evanet points out, can even increase their allure. The remaining sectors exposed, namely machinery, Nespresso pods, and medical devices, might pose minimal short-term damage to the Swiss economy.
Now, all of this, when you put all this together, I suspect we, at the end of the year, we will look at this as a bad year for Swiss trade, but not a catastrophic year.
Still, the shock of the tariffs has been a blow to Swiss pride and identity.
Der Bundesrat ist einfach, enttäuscht, weil wir
and will require long-term soul-searching about how Switzerland wants to conduct itself in a geopolitically fractured world. Conservative factions of the Swiss political spectrum, says Vermouth, including the Swiss People's Party, currently a majority, have long held an affinity for the United States. For them, the tariffs strike at the heart of this ideological kinship.
Not even Trump does understand. There is a very special, let's say, historical feeling in Switzerland that we consider ourselves kind of a sister republic of the United States of America. And it's a very fundamental shock, at least for conservative and right-wing politicians, to be kind of disappointed by this sister republic. And that's something that goes into the very heart of Swiss identity. That's part of why we always saw ourselves kind of the Americans in Europe.
A 25% increase. We're going to bring it.
The age of America First has proved once and for all that the Swiss, and especially its conservative leaders, cannot count on that affinity being bilateral. In a multipolar world, a go-it-alone attitude in Europe has its costs. Jesse Ujewska-Stevens, Geneva.
Just a quick reminder here that our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Laura Kabelka in Berlin. Now, how often do you stop and listen? Really listen. Most of us live in a world overflowing with sound, from the whirring of a bedroom fan to the cacophony of noise greeting us when we open our front doors. The sounds that surround us and what they might tell us take center stage at this year's Momentum Biennale in Norway. We sent Lars Bevanger to check out the contemporary art exhibition and to lend an ear.
Momentum is the Nordic Biennale of contemporary art, and Gallery F15 has been the main space, and now we really focus on using the public space around the gallery and also in Moss.
Nicholas Hughes is the curator of mediation at Gallery F15, housed in an old farmstead surrounded by beautiful woodland near the city of Moss, around an hour south of Oslo.
So there's this real balance of contemporary art and nature. And this momentum, this specific momentum, is based on sound art. So all the artists work with sound as a medium in some respect.
Many of the installations here highlight topical but perhaps somewhat forgotten issues, like this one called Viz Unnecessary Force No. 4 by Norwegian-based Mexican artist Luz Maria Sanchez.
What you see on site at Momentum is an oval of loudspeakers that are arranged at ear level, and there's an invitation to the visitors to activate the loudspeakers.
Her work addresses the forced disappearances of people in Mexico at the hands of drug cartels. Sanchez's recordings are from one of the expeditions of Las Rastreadoras de El Fuerte, or the Trackers of El Fuerte. These are groups of women searching for buried victims, often relatives. Sanchez is documenting their strong community bonds through sounds of them talking and laughing together, as well as sounds of them digging up clandestine graves in the hope of identifying the disappeared.
This very touching way of being together, I think that helps also the general public when they know about these stories. It is not just the harsh of the search, but it's also the need of being together and be alive, to keep on searching. And I think that's what I tried to share in this artwork.
This is a very visual story too. You've got some pictures on the walls, but why have you chosen sound as your principal medium?
I feel like when you are exposed to visual elements, you can close your eyes, but sound is always there. Even if we decide not to listen, we're hearing. We cannot close our ears. So when you're there and you're listening and the sound is surrounding you and you can hear their voices and how they move from one place to the other, you are in the middle of that. So you are really in the middle of this action that I try to translate into the exhibition space.
It's out here in the woods surrounding the actual gallery where the interaction of nature and sound really comes to life. This installation by Norwegian-British artist Natasha Barrett picks up the natural sounds of trees, wind and humans and amplify it through speakers hidden in the trees around me, playing it back on a slightly distorted loop. It's hard to tell where nature starts and where the sound creation begins. Walking around the entire exhibition space, a forest, fields and gardens near the fjord, takes about an hour. Or it could take days, depending on how long you want to linger. I'm approaching another hidden work of art, and I think I'll let the artist tell you about it.
I am Jakob Kierkegaard. I'm a Danish sound artist, composer. The installation is called The Grey Zone Neverwhere, and it consists of sound recordings that I made in Chernobyl in 2005 of a swimming pool, of course abandoned like the rest of Chernobyl. But this swimming pool had a particular sound because water was dripping from the ceiling.
So you could say I'm in the middle of Jakob Kierkegaard's artwork now. Come away from the path a little bit. I cannot see any speakers hidden in the trees, but I know they're there. I can hear the dripping from Chernobyl, intermingled with the breeze in the actual trees here. It's quite a juxtaposition, but it really works.
The inspiration for creating this piece comes from way back when I was traveling in the nature in Chernobyl. That is a place where I cannot see that there is something wrong, the radioactivity that is everywhere. But I know it's there. And that knowledge twists my perception of my concept of nature. Nature as something good, a place I want to lie down in the grass and feel connected to the nature. But here, because of my knowledge, my whole perception of reality, of the world, twisted just a little bit.
What this exhibition truly reminds you to do is to stop and really listen. That is something we have lost in today's busy world, believes artist Jakob Kierkegaard.
The interesting thing about listening is that it takes time. You can look at a picture and you can just look for 1 second, but you want to listen to a piece of music or sound art, it takes time and you also need to be quiet. I once read somebody said that he was happy that more and more people were wearing headphones in the city because that meant that more and more people were listening to music. But I think most people just wear it to block off, because maybe people have given up listening or looking up from their phones.
Lars Bevanger, DW in Moss, Norway.
And if that whets your appetite for a trip to Norway, the Momentum Biennale runs until October 12th, featuring more than 40 artists from 5 continents. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Laura Kabelka in Germany.
7 a.m. Berlin, Olaf Scholz is getting on the plane. I'll be on board as well, and I'll brief you at Berlin Briefing.
Berlin is right in the middle of the global tensions of our time.
Between East and West, autocrats and democrats, Germany's whole system is under stress. Politics is getting angry. We break it all down with experts and political players. And we decode what it means for you.
It's all in our new podcast, Berlin Briefing. Listen on all platforms.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio program from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Laura Kabelka in Berlin. In France, last month, an 18-year-old man was arrested on his way to school after police, who had been following his internet activity on the Manosphere, saw a message he posted threatening murder. He was found to be carrying two long knives. And he's been charged with terrorism. The first time in the country that terrorism charges have been brought against someone identified as part of the incel movement, where incel stands for involuntary celibate. From Paris, John Laurenson reports.
C'est une première en France, un attentat d'un masculiniste revendiqué.
French TV viewers discovered a few weeks ago that for the first time in this country, a young man believed by police to be under the influence of what the French call masculinist ideology had been arrested for terrorism. Apparently, the young man had been on the brink of carrying out a deadly knife attack.
Gaël Charnay et Quincy Russell.
Identified only as Timothy G., police had been following his online activity for several weeks because he'd become active in incel chat groups. On the morning of his arrest, he posted, "If they don't let me into 11th grade, I'm going to commit carnage." Police swooped, found two knives in his school bag. They immediately classified the incident as an act of terrorism, as Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin explained. "This is terrorism in the proper sense of the word," he said. "The incel movement is," he said, "astonishing for the French, but these people are capable of killing women because they believe they are responsible for society's evils." Evian Leidig is an independent researcher specialised in online extremism and radicalisation.
The arrest of this young man is representative of what is a growing threat of violent misogynistic terrorism, some of which could be classified as incel, although not all violent misogynists do identify with that incel label.
Was his young age typical?
When it comes at least to violent misogynists or to incel perpetrators, they tend to err on the younger side. These are usually boys between the ages of even as young as 13, but more commonly late teenage years to early adulthood. Whereas when it comes, for example, to, say, extreme right or Islamist attacks, we tend to see perpetrators on the older age spectrum.
You mentioned Islamist attacks, for example. Europol, as you would have seen, published a few days ago stats on terrorist attacks in 2024, the biggest number. The only deadly attacks, in fact, were jihadi attacks. Then a close second came left-wing and anarchist. There was one non-fatal attack described as right-wing. Does this mean that incel violence is, for the moment at least, a comparatively small-scale phenomenon?
Well, based on Europol's report, it could indicate that perhaps violent misogyny or incel attacks are marginal in comparison to some other ideological motivators. But it is, unfortunately, a type of violence that we're seeing grow as there's been more reported cases of individuals inspired by violent misogyny or incel ideology. But the other difficulty with this type of attack is that oftentimes governments don't have the legal frameworks in place to be able to classify individuals under this, you know, incel as an act of terrorism. We've only started to see a couple of governments, for example, in Canada, that for the first time prosecuted individuals with incel-motivated ideology.
Would you say that the incel mindset is linked to other mindsets or ideologies that might be described as terrorist?
We do see a close alignment between incels and right-wing extremism, but that's mainly because we see misogyny being the glue between these two different types of motivations. However, when it comes to incels or to violent misogynists, one way that we can separate them from the extreme right is a very sole focus on targeting women and LGBTQ individuals and not necessarily having such a clear political ideology that right-wing extremists might have in terms of anti-immigration, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, etc. So there are some very clear differences with incel terrorism compared to other types of ideological violence.
Meanwhile, the 18-year-old suspected of being France's first incel terrorist is being held in custody, with the judiciary rejecting a call from his lawyer to allow him to await trial outside of prison.
John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
Incels are a subgroup of a larger phenomenon, the manosphere. It's a whole spectrum of online communities where men discuss masculinity, relationships, looks, and gender politics. Let's take a deep dive.
What is going on with young men right now?
The manosphere.
Proliferation of misogyny online.
The manosphere.
The manosphere.
Men are at the most risk of social isolation.
A majority of British young men regularly engage with masculinity influencers online.
Most people would rail against being called a misogynist, but not Andrew Tate.
So what kind of voices do you find on the manosphere? At the extreme end, you have the former kickboxer and alleged sex trafficker Andrew Tate.
But females are barely sentient. Even the good ones.
The manosphere also includes countless other voices, like Bismarck Ebiwe, Cliff Watley, Austin Dunham, or David Cooley.
How to properly look max.
Everybody's a high-value woman until it's time to submit.
Here are three signs that you have some small D, beta male energy.
The media is controlled by women.
There are also much more complex voices that, whilst not strictly part of the manosphere itself, could be described as manosphere adjacent, like the Canadian public intellectual Jordan Peterson.
It's a very rare woman who, at the age of 30, doesn't consider having a child her primary desire. And the ones that don't consider that, generally, in my observation, there's something that isn't quite right.
Joe Rogan, Spotify's most streamed podcaster, holds a broad range of political opinions and is critical of extremes. However, because of his repeated platforming of anti-feminist figures, researchers often see him as a mainstream gateway to the manosphere, particularly when he voices incel-influenced theories like this.
Women are only attracted to 20% of the men.
The manosphere ranges from outright misogynistic content to tips on how to get ripped and rich. But anti-feminism does unify this sphere.
One of the common narratives is that men are the victims, the true victims in feminist-dominated societies. What we see here is actually the reframing of gender justice as a threat to male identity. It's a powerful echo chamber.
You just heard from Ellie Scambor, the research director of the Institute for Masculinity Research and Gender Studies in Graz, Austria. You'll hear more from her later. The manosphere is part of a larger trend around the world, namely the call for a return to supposedly traditional values. And many analysts are crediting the manosphere with playing a big role in an emerging gender split that's playing out in elections all over the world. Young men voting to the right, young women becoming more liberal. But why is this backlash against progressive policies particularly seen in young men? And how does the popularity of the manosphere affect us all?
Because it really does seem to boys that the world hates men at times. So it's very easy to distort that and go, yeah, the world does hate men. I don't hate you. Come this way. And that's what happened with me.
This is Will Adolfi. He's now in his early 30s and lives on the coast in the UK. He first got in touch with the manosphere about 13 years ago. And he really got into it.
Every free moment I had, really, yeah.
I got to speak to Will about what attracted him and so many other men and boys to this kind of content. You will also hear from researchers who explain the impact of the manosphere on men's health, why this concerns everyone and what can be done about it. I would like to place a trigger warning here. This will not be an easy journey. Even if you've not watched his content, you've probably heard of the notorious influencer Andrew Tate. Or perhaps you've seen the gut-wrenching British miniseries Adolescence. And angry men identifying with incel culture sometimes do turn online misogyny into real-life murder, as happened in California in 2014, or Canada in 2018, or Florida in the same year, or New Mexico the year before. But the manosphere is nuanced. It's not one coherent group. And it's constantly evolving. So before we follow Will down the manosphere rabbit hole and back, here's a quick glossary of terms and symbols as a starting point. Research Director Ellie Scambor will walk us through.
incels, short for involuntary celibates.
What they believe is that they are structurally denied access to intimate relationship and sex, and they blame women for it. They also have a quite clear concept about the hierarchical order of men. So men who are considered attractive, for example, and successful, they are labeled as chads, they call them chads, and incels perceive themselves as genetically disadvantaged, as lonely, as unloved, as devalued.
The 80-20 rule, or the Pareto principle.
The incel interpretation of the 80-20 rule is 80% of women want the top of the 20% of men. What they say is women are choosing only the very attractive man, the highest status man, the chads, and rejecting all the other men, the average man, and the low-value man, and they see themselves as the low-value man.
Pickup artists.
For them, the role of women is different. Success with women is a matter of training and strategies. So they provide videos and they show behavioral tactics, very often framed through pseudo-scientific arguments, tactics to control women, to manipulate intimate relationship. Women here are not enemies, but they are targets to be won over, and actually they are completely devalued also.
Men going their own way.
This group doesn't really see connection to women, but complete withdrawal. So they see relationship with women as inherently dangerous, as actually damaging men. So their concept of masculinity is centered on autonomy and detachments.
Looks maxing.
The strategy of maximizing improvement of the physical appearance. There's a wide range of strategies, quite extreme measures. So they talk about physical fitness, muscle building and so on, but also dental procedures, for example, jaw corrections that should be made.
Alpha versus beta.
Chads would be alpha men from their perspective. So they differentiate between the men who are chosen from women, so the 80-20 rule, and the alpha men would be part of this group.
Austrian research director Ellie Scambor there. But now back to Will, who spent a few years consuming such content. I asked him to describe his life before entering the manosphere.
I remember being 14 years old and just finding everything too much, home life, school life. I was crying on my mum's bed and she put her hand on me and she said to me, "You care too much." And that was her way of supporting me. And so from that point on, I kind of became the whatever I don't care man. At school, I started to act out. I started to fight back.
Will told me that he was struggling with mental health issues. Heading into his 20s, it got worse. He started having panic attacks and bouts of depression.
And I just felt submerged by emotional intensity. I was lost. I wasn't earning that much. And also 2016, so the world had begun to kind of express resentment towards masculinity, towards the man box, towards men, the Me Too movement was happening, and there was this rhetoric and message that I was receiving directly from people to my face and often online, which was, "You've had your time, men, you're privileged."
Research director Ellie Scambo says that just like Will, many men experience current developments such as gender equality policies as a loss of orientation.
We see that public discourses increasingly center the voices of marginalized groups, thinking about people of color, queer communities. This is urgently needed, but some may see it as a loss of their own relevance. So the return to traditional models can be seen as an attempt to reclaim visibility, to get it back.
Will interpreted this rhetoric as claiming that men have it easy and it's time for women to come to the front. But he felt that he'd never had it easy, that he'd never been at the front. It didn't feel fair.
I really just wanted to let these people know how difficult life was for me at that time. I didn't want to be here. So you can understand how confusing it is as someone who's struggling so much with their mental health to then be told that they're privileged. It's just It's a really hard thing to like to process. And there's something about the way in which we're still socializing boys and men, which has a direct impact on our capacity to process emotions.
This last point again relates to the man box, a term Will mentioned earlier.
The man box.
A kind of invisible set of rules, let's call it cultural expectations, that define how, under question marks now, a real man should think, a real man should feel or should behave. And these rules are surprisingly consistent across different countries and cultures.
Inside this box, Ellie tells me, are rigid ideas like a man must never show fear or vulnerability. He must act tough, not cook, make money and solve problems alone. In a recent study with 3,000 men in the UK, Mexico and the US, researchers found that on average, a third of the respondents identified with such gender norms.
Especially for young men who feel insecure or who feel isolated, these very traditional ideas still offer a sense of belonging and structure. So the problem is, if you stay in the man box, if you share these thoughts, if you internalize it, you constantly have to prove your manhood. And often the pressure becomes also self-destructive. And this is where we see a direct connection to the manosphere, where these traditional expectations, even hyper-masculinity ideas, are not just preserved, but actively celebrated and radicalized.
Will's dream back then was to become a famous actor. He wanted money and to be attractive for women.
When I met the reality after university, which I trained as an actor, the reality was, oh my goodness, everything's so expensive. I was living in London. I was paying £750 per month to live in this shed that literally had no window. The one thing I had was, okay, I'm going to start a business. So I started a theatre company. I put everything into this theatre company and I was working at a school. And yeah, it was around this sort of time I started to watch podcasts or listen to podcasts and watch YouTube clips.
Will was looking for guidance and self-improvement. And like so many others, he found advice online.
This content is mainstream. It's not a subculture. But actually, for most young men, they're not entering this space because they're looking for violent, misogynistic, harmful content. They're entering it because they're looking for advice, normally advice about like dating, advice about making money, advice about getting fit. And they're entering it through kind of the most mainstream conduit, which is likely to be kind of one of the big name influencers.
You just heard from Sarah Sternberg. She's the global director for Reimagining Masculinities at the Movember Foundation. Movember started as this small movement for men to sport a moustache in November to spark conversations about men's health. Now they're the biggest charity working on this topic globally. Sarah told me that for a lot of men, manosphere influencers can be motivating, inspiring. That was also the case for Will at first.
I was watching guys in suits, academics, who at first sounded incredibly reasonable. I felt validated, I felt seen, and it was so captivating. The voice, it drew me in. It was articulate, bold, clear, confident. And these people were saying things that I didn't think I could say, that I wanted to say. And then what happens when a person gets pulled in and one develops an emotional attachment to the influencer, like I did, this person became a father figure to me.
You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Laura Kabelka in Germany. It's for the grandkids, not just because you're fighting with a diamond. Yeah. My lines are firing like a nine is. Hear them sirens, why? Because I'm short line is. I'm not fighting with the height is. Because you're fighting on the mic and they never like this. 6'4, you can try, can I oversight this? One small put this in your pipe and the light it. Big man, you can size it. Big man, you can size it. Big man, you can fight it. But the Lord knows it and why is if you try it. Big man, you can size it. Big man, you can size it. Big man, you can fight it. But the Lord knows it and why is if you try it. So Will would spend every free moment watching or listening to this content. It helped him get out of the ditch he was in. But then the content started to change.
It just became more and more resentful towards women. Before I knew it, I was living in a binary world where it felt like you were either on side or you were against me. Fundamentally, it was really hard to like experience inner peace because I had these polarity of voices in my head, like the masculinity influencer arguing with like a feminist in my head. And It impacted my relationship with my partner at the time. You know, whenever she would talk about her experiences as a woman, I just felt like it was threatening my experience as a man.
So in the short term, Will received some benefits. But in the long term, he told me, this content further contributed to his depression, anxiety, anger, feeling of worthlessness, and ultimately suicide risk. The Movember charity did a large-scale study on the effects of masculinity influencers, which suggests that this is not a coincidence. They found that those regularly engaged with this content are more likely to report feelings associated with poor mental health.
They're also much more likely to take risky health behaviours, so they're much more likely to take steroids, diet pills, exercise when injured, than those who don't regularly engage.
Will said that ultimately the deeper issues in his life were going unaddressed, and he still felt isolated and lonely, also reinforced by this us versus them worldview. In the offline world, he told me, he didn't have many discussions about politics or feminism because it would just turn into an argument and then he'd shut down.
The harder thing to realize is just the conversations I wasn't having, rather than the conversations I was having.
So fast forward a few years to today.
This meeting is being recorded.
There we go. Hi, can everyone hear me okay? We've got a couple.
Will has changed his life completely. He's now a psychotherapist and he goes to schools across the country to talk to boys about what happened to him and to create spaces for them to open up as well. You can follow him on Instagram at PsychWill, where he runs monthly Q&As to support parents in navigating what he calls the online masculinity crisis. I asked him how all this change came about.
Empathy was the answer. I empathized myself and then I began to feel empathy for other people. And then this kind of threat detection system of like, is this person against me? Are they with me? It just kind of relaxed. And I started to see, I was like, oh my God, we all want the same thing. We all want to be seen. We all want to be heard. The fear started to go away because I had these relationships with people that I had once demonized in my head. Started to meet, you know, women that was, told me they were feminists. I'd started to meet, I met a non-binary person. And just slowly but surely, I started to realize that the online world is very different from the real world. The real world is far more complicated and far more nuanced than this binary worldview I had developed. So my worldview just started to crumble, really.
This process was a slow one. First, Will focused on himself. Then, he reflected on his main influencer and took him off the pedestal. He started to rebuild through conversations where he didn't feel judged. Will emphasized this because he says when boys and men feel judged, it can bring up shame, anger, and defensiveness.
I have learned that that shuts down the conversation. It disengages boys. And when boys are disengaged, guess who engages them? Guess what engages them? It's the online world.
That's exactly why research director Ellie Scambor recommends the following approach to parents and teachers.
We need to create a space for open discussion, for open conversation, a curious conversation. We should rather ask questions than listen than giving advice. Instead of saying that's nonsense, we should rather ask kids, what's interesting about the video? Why is it important for you?
Ellie also says that there is still a lack of awareness, that many still don't understand that especially young people are living online. These digital spaces are not a separate part of one's life. She suggests looking for the following signs that someone is drifting into the manosphere.
This can include misogynist statements or anti-queer remarks. It could include withdrawal, for example, from friends or also from the families. Or it could include that suddenly the term red pill or black pill is used, or the 80-20 rule, or they talk about femoid.
Femoid, females.
A dehumanizing term for women, meaning they are not real human.
Red pill, black pill.
I think you know the movie Matrix. If you take a red pill, this stands for awakening. You can realize that you are being oppressed in a feminist system. If you take the blue pill, you can't realize it. The black pill ideology represents more a radical hopelessness. They have a very nihilistic concept about themselves and they cannot change it and they blame women for this. And this is why some of them really, they take the gun and go out and kill women.
In the UK, a YouGov study in 2023 found that only 1 in 6 boys aged 6 to 15 have a positive view of Andrew Tate, but most of them do know him. And according to Will, the fact that they are watching this content means it will creep into their heads.
Just because someone is saying they don't like or do like, what I have learned is it's very hard to know how what I'm watching is impacting me. Because if I'm watching it over and over and over, it almost becomes like a form of brainwashing.
The manosphere is not only filling, but also profiting from a void. Let's not forget, these influencers are making money off this content. Controversial streamer Sneeko, for example, said he was making tens of thousands of dollars monthly on YouTube alone. That was, of course, before he was banned for violating community guidelines. Men and boys want to be addressed. They are looking for answers to their struggles. There are other role models out there, however.
The reality is that boys won't just be boys. Boys will be what we teach them to be.
Ben Hurst, for example, is promoting healthy masculinity online, and he also gives workshops at schools. GQ magazine calls him one of the anti-Tates. But his account seems like a drop in the ocean compared to the millions of views that Andrew Tate videos, uploaded by third parties since Tate's accounts were blocked, still attract. Apart from healthier role models, Sarah Sternberg from Movember says that it's important to focus on community building and destigmatizing emotional vulnerability.
And so a big part of our work at Movember is thinking about kind of what can be done to strengthen young men's friendships and relationships with one another, particularly as they kind of emerge into adulthood. I think there's some really sad statistic that by the age of 40, I think 1 in 5 men have like no close friends. So male friendship is something that really does sort of disappear for young men as they get older. And that's not the case for women. And we know that like social connections have such a powerful role to play in like protecting your health.
Sarah told me that they're also training therapists to better adapt to men's needs. And men's health, she argues, isn't only an issue affecting men.
Men's health, I think, is an area of focus for us, partly because it is underfunded and underexplored, but also because it has a big social impact on those around men. There are links, certainly, around mental health, poor mental health, and men and kind of violence.
As we've heard earlier, those consuming manosphere content reported feelings associated with poorer health, and that ripples out to affect others. Just look at the correlation between poor mental health and domestic violence, for example. So if we do succeed in supporting young men properly, if we acknowledge their struggles, move beyond the man box and provide healthier role models, this would benefit everyone. Elise Gambor has the statistics to prove it. Her Institute for Masculinity Research and Gender Studies has conducted a new cross-Austria study, and it shows that a fair distribution of unpaid care work within the family can prevent domestic violence. When the father, however, has the final say in family decisions, for example, the risk of physical violence against children is greatest. Focusing on men's health and struggles doesn't have to take away from the importance of women's or minorities' issues.
It's really important for me to say that and be explicit about it. It's an and, not an or.
Will Adolfi agrees.
And we get trapped in that limbo, this zero-sum game of, if we talk about your pain, then that devalidates mine. And what I have learned is that there's space for it all.
And that's it for today. This program was produced by Kate Laycock and me, Laura Kabelka. Our sound engineers were Michael Springer and Ben Zemke. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn and Berlin.